8. Metal tubing held the giant dinner fork a foot or so above a rough slab of concrete. Two basketball-sized stones and a third larger one sat in the sand in front of it, as if some giant had stabbed at them and just missed. A sculpture or an art installation of some kind. Eli walked up to it. Silver paint gave the fork the color and texture of brushed aluminum. He wrapped his knuckles against it and heard a wooden clunk. Thick, but hollow. He walked around the fork looking for a plaque or an inscription or maybe a small note held in place on the frame with a magnet. Nothing. He turned and looked at the trio of stones. Were they markers? He leaned over the closest one and looked for letters or numbers or symbols of some kind. He heard a click behind him, metal on metal, just loud enough to stand out from the ambient sound of passing cars and the distant lawnmower. The sound probably hadn't made it out of the small park. Eli turned. Harry's long flintlock rifle was a dark circle to his eyes, only recognizable from the way her hands held it. Recognition sparked in her eyes and her glare softened, but not much.
Mr. Teague?
Harry, he said. He let his hands drift out, not up over his head, but plainly open and empty.
You're early. Not as early as I'd hoped, she said. What are you doing here?
Trying to find you.
And you have, she said.
She took a few steps toward him, but the rifle didn't shift from his head.
You'll please pardon my saying, but I find running into you again on the other side of the country a bit disturbing.
Imagine what it feels like at gunpoint. Her mouth twitched, but the rifle still didn't move.
How did you find me?
Theo, he said. The salesman's surname popped to mind. Theo Knickerbocker.
How do you know Theo?
I went to Quincy Market looking for you and found him. Well, he found me. He tried to sell me a necklace. We talked for a couple minutes and he figured out I was looking for you.
Did he now?
Yeah. He told me you were coming here. The rifle shifted in her hands.
Theo doesn't just tell people things, she said.
The words were ice. Eli realized she'd wrapped her finger around the trigger.
I paid him, he said.
$25 cash. He told me you'd be here now and gave me a bracelet. He reached for his pocket to pull out the trinket, but stopped as her grip tightened on the rifle. Harry stared at him.
What were you looking for?
What?
Just now when I found you, what were you looking for?
Nothing, he said. I was just looking, trying to figure out what you were coming here for. She said nothing. The rifle barrel wavered between a black dot and a blurred, foreshortened rod. It's pointed at one of my eyes, Eli realized.
I thought you'd need... Why are you following me, Mr. Teague?
To warn you about the faceless man? She took in a fast, short breath.
When?
Just a few days ago. The day after I helped you change the flat tire, he showed up at the bank where I work. He was looking for you, and then he followed me to Boston and killed Theo. The rifle wobbled, the barrel tilted down.
Theo's dead?
He shot him in the head.
And you got away?
He was focused on Theo. I got to the edge of the market and ran. Her mouth trembled for a moment.
Do you have a firearm?
A what?
A firearm, a gun. A pistol hidden somewhere on your person?
He shook his head. No, nothing.
Excellent.
The rifle came up and became solid again.
Toward me, please.
What? She tipped her head toward the scrub behind the fork and made a small shooing gesture with the rifle's tip.
This way, quickly, please.
He walked toward and past the large utensil. Her boots shifted in the dirt, swinging her around the fork so it never came between Eli and the rifle. He headed to the edge of the dirt oval and paused at the scrub plants. He glanced right, then left. Past the intersection to his left, the Model A business coupe sat against the curb, the andalusite blue all but black on the tree-shaded street. He leaned his head back.
You're not really going to shoot me, are you? Don't be daft, Mr. Teague. Do you have the time?
He glanced at his watch. It's almost 1:30.
How close?
He looked again. 1:27? He looked over his shoulder.
What happens at 1:30?
She stood a few feet away. Her aim had relaxed and she stared up at the fork. She looked at him, then passed him to the scrub.
Close enough, she muttered. See the fork's shadow, the top of it?
He looked down at the scrub. His own shadow was a dark blob across the tan and green plants, but the fork's long shadow reached past him. Its edge sat almost a yard into the growth.
Yeah, he said. Yeah, I do. Dig there.
What?
Dig,
she repeated. He stepped toward the shadow's edge and the plants crunched under his feet. A few stronger branches scraped at his ankles. He moved to the side, double-checked the fork's shadow, and kneeled. One of his hands pushed into the low bushes. The brown leaves scraped at his fingers and palm. He glanced back at Harry.
Dig.
The words had more emphasis this time. What for?
Because I have a rifle and you don't. No, I mean, what am I digging for? Am I just making a hole? Or just dig, Mr. Teague. You'll know when you find it.
He looked at the rifle, then her, then back to the muzzle.
I don't suppose you could... If what you say is true, we don't have a lot of time,
she told him.
It's best if you just keep your mind to the task at hand so we can both be gone before anyone finds us here. Dig.
He sighed and set both hands to work. He pushed the low branches and leaves out of the way. They moved without effort, lifting up and folding back. Two or three of the plants had been snapped off and left in the tangle of branches. A rough circle of dirt beneath them was dark and loose. He could see parallel trails where someone had run their fingers back and forth to smooth the ground. He held back the scrub with one hand while the other pawed at the ground. The soil came up easily. It felt like digging at the beach, although the grains felt larger and coarser. He went down a few inches, then clawed at the sides of his hole to widen it. The ground there resisted, reinforced by a web of thread-like roots. Another group of cars drove by, and Eli wondered if anyone saw the woman holding him at rifle point. No one called out or honked horns. Wasn't Los Angeles supposed to be all about guns and drive-by shootings? Did they not notice or just not care? He hadn't even dug for 2 minutes when his fingers brushed something smooth and angled 8 inches down. They found the shape again and pulled it from its tiny grave. He flipped it over in his hand, and a few quick swipes knocked most of the dirt from it. This it? He asked Harry. The soil hadn't even stained the little packet of wax paper. It had been cleverly folded into a square envelope, maybe 3 inches on each side. Through the tacky paper, Eli could feel something round, maybe the size of a half dollar, although the packet seemed too light for a... Harry snatched it from his fingers. She tugged on one of the folds, and the packet bloomed like a paper flower in her hand. She plucked something from the center and closed her fist around it. She murmured something Eli couldn't hear and let out a deep sigh. The rifle lowered and drifted to the side. Eli stood up and coughed. So what is it? She glanced at him.
Thank you for the warning, Mr. Teague, she said. You have my appreciation, although I'm sorry you came all this way for nothing.
What's that supposed to mean?
It means you should run back home as fast as you can. Forget you were here, forget you saw me, go back to your life and be thankful for it. Forget,
he shook his head.
What the hell is going on? You have, if I understand the phrase correctly, jumped into the deep end of the pool. You should go home now while you can. They haven't directly connected you to me. You're just a witness.
Like Theo was?
Theo'd been playing the odds for a while. It won't be the same for you.
She waved the rifle, and the movement made her ponytail swing out from behind her head.
Go.
They both heard the growl at the same time. A rumbling engine that stood out even over the SUVs and sports cars rolling past the traffic island. The sound came from the bend to the south, echoing off the houses.
Run,
Harry whispered. She shoved the mystery item inside her jacket. The rifle came back up.
Run now. What about you?
The growl rose and became a roar. Eli glanced to the side and saw people in the passing cars glancing at their dashboards, then out to the streets.
Mr. Teague, this is no time for chivalry or nobility. Please, you need to get away from here as fast as you can. Run until you drop and then keep crawling.
I'm not going to just leave you to deal with... The Hudson Hornet ignored the stoplight and shot through the intersection. The black, glossy finish reflected the sky and the sun and the other cars. The roadster aimed itself at Eli and Harry.
Damn it, said Harry.
She backed into him, forced him around the fork. The moment slowed in time. The Hornet's tires were already up on the island. The driver's side of the car plowed through one of the pointy bushes. Grit sprayed up from the other tire. Eli saw the faceless man behind the wheel. The plastic mask gazed back at him. Harry's rifle went off. The Hornet's passenger side tire exploded. The car lurched to the side, crushing two more pointy bushes under its bulk before the driver could compensate. The Hornet slid into the dirt oval and came to rest. The passenger door sat just a few feet from the concrete base of the fork.
"I'm sorry," said Eli. "I don't know how he followed me here."
The driver's door opened and the faceless man rose up out of the car. His clear mask now had round cheeks and a wide cartoon smile like a clown. He had changed his suit, too. The deep blue pinstripe made him look thinner, and a silk handkerchief poked out from the breast pocket. A tiny gray tuft rode on one side of the hat tucked into the band. It was an old man's hat, or a hat young men wore in old pictures.
"He isn't following you," Harry said.
She swung the rifle up, aiming at the sky, and then pushed it into Eli's hands.
"This is the one that's been after me."
9.
"Hello," said the faceless man, turning its mask toward Eli. "Please drop the weapon, Mr. Teague. If you could both put your hands above your head, it would..."
The sides of Harry's colonial coat flapped open. Her hands swung up, each holding a pistol. The guns thundered in the open space. 3, 4, 5, too many shots, and the faceless man staggered back, kicked hard in the chest. Eli flinched away, glanced back, and saw no blood on the fallen man. Harry spun, shoulder-checked him, and ran. 3 long strides carried her past him, over the plants, to the sidewalk. Tires squealed and horns wailed again as she sprinted across the street.
"Come on!"
she bellowed over her shoulder. The faceless man sat up next to his car. He didn't seem to notice the bullet holes in his coat or pale shirt. He reached for his fallen pistol, a movement with no urgency behind it. Another mirror-black Hudson Hornet roared up Pasadena Avenue, and another chorus of tires and horns echoed across the small park as drivers avoided it. Eli heard the heavy, hollow crunch of 2 cars colliding as the big sedan charged onto the island and came to rest along the southern point of the triangular park. Eli turned and ran. He lurched, thrown off balance by the flintlock rifle he clutched and didn't dare release. The leafy plants crunched under his feet.
"Hello, Mr. Teague," boomed a voice behind him. "You were instructed to remain in your hometown. You haven't followed these instructions."
The cars in the street hadn't worked back up to speed, so Eli earned more angry honks than screeching brakes as he dove through traffic. An SUV scuffed its tires and bumped him just hard enough to stagger him. The rifle clattered against the grill. The big truck's driver, a woman with platinum blonde hair, shouted at Eli through the windshield. Then the windshield spiderwebbed with a bang as a gunshot rang out behind him. The driver screamed. Eli barely pushed himself off the big car's hood before she gunned the accelerator and sped away. 20 yards ahead, Harry yanked open the Model A's passenger door. She threw herself across the rumble seat and behind the wheel. The engine coughed once and let out a roar of its own. The car lunged forward a few feet just as Eli reached it. He dove into the passenger space just as Harry slammed the car into reverse. Momentum threw Eli off the seat, and the flapping door banged against his shin. The rifle's barrel hit him in the side of the head. Outside, the pavement rushed past the car. He pushed himself back up onto the bench. Harry had her arm over the seat, craning her neck to see out the rear window while she drove full speed down the street in reverse. The transmission whined with the effort. Through the windshield, Eli could see the faceless men. 2 of them. They stood in the middle of the street and stared down the road after the old car. A horn blared. Harry swerved the car and Eli grabbed the dash to keep from being flung out the passenger door. The Model A swerved again, sharp. The wheels on the passenger side lifted off the road and Eli slid back into the car, bumping up against Harry. She shoved him away and slammed the pedals to the Model A's floor. The vehicle lunged forward. The passenger door slammed shut, and the seat back hit Eli right below the shoulder blades. The rifle shook free of his grip and fell between him and the door. Harry spun the steering wheel back and forth, hand over hand, like she was piloting a ship. The Model A wove through traffic. She ignored the yellow line and earned a few blaring horns and shouts. It took Eli a moment to recognize the cylindrical speedometer, but it swung back and forth with every sharp turn. He guessed their speed at around 60 miles an hour. Through what looked like a residential area, maybe even the outskirts of some kind of college. The engine didn't seem to be straining at all. Harry wove around a pickup and muttered something under her breath. She spun the wheel again and the passenger door thumped Eli in the side. There didn't seem to be any seat belts. which made sense for a 1929 Model A, he realized. What? Eli flinched as the old car slid between a moving truck and a green sedan. What just happened? The Model A swooped around another corner. Eli braced his feet and pushed himself back against the seat. He didn't slide as much this time. Can we slow down a little? No. The road ahead was empty. Harry shot straight through the stop sign at the end of the block without hesitation. She glanced over her shoulder without slowing. Eli looked back, too. The road looked empty for at least two blocks, but then he caught a glimpse of something black and gleaming. He could hear the growl of the Hudson Hornet's big engine as it closed on them.
We have to get out of their range, she said.
Their what?
Their range.
Harry turned right at the next corner. There were no other cars, but she still didn't slow down. Eli pushed himself into the seat and managed to not end up pressed against her again. He heard tires screech and skid behind them, and the growl grew louder. He glanced through the rear window and saw the Hornet just a few dozen yards back. The Model A blasted through another stop sign. This time it got them a sharp bleat from a small blue car. The next cross street had a full stoplight, which Harry also ignored. Eli heard brakes squeal and flinched away from a close view of a bus headlight, and then they were through the intersection. Behind them, he heard a sharp squeal of brakes, and the deep growl faded away. He spread his feet a little wider as they went around the next corner. Again, Harry didn't move. She almost rode the car's controls, standing on the pedals and using the steering wheel to pull herself up off the rumble seat. It made him think of kids on bikes using their own weight to force every ounce of speed out of their cranks. Her ponytail swung out to the side and then back. The growl of the Hudson Hornet's engine faded more. Eli couldn't be sure, but it sounded like the car was driving in a different direction. It sounded like a distant freeway. Harry glanced at Eli, then back to the road.
When people are scared, she said, they tend to move in straight lines. That's why most people search for them that way.
They do?
Have you ever heard stories of children lost in the woods, when it takes days to find them? How often are they right near where they first vanished? No one can find them because they're in the last place most people think to look.
Eli looked at the houses and cars as they flew past. Isn't everything in the last place you look, technically?
The problem is, she continued, ignoring him, if we don't make any turns, we just end up going where they expect us to go and they catch us. But if we make too many turns, we don't get out of their range.
And they can catch us? Eli guessed. She nodded once and spun them around another corner. A small dog on a leash yipped at them twice.
What do you mean their range? Can they see somehow? Do they have...
The memory of a blind superhero danced on the edge of Eli's thoughts.
I don't know, radar sense or something? Mr. Teague, she said, right now I'm spending a small part of my concentration driving this car, and a very large part reminding myself I shouldn't kick you out and leave you for them to find. Please consider this before distracting me or asking any further questions.
The Model A swerved around a pack of bicyclists, then cut them off to take another corner. Half a dozen angry men and women glared at Eli through orange-lensed glasses as the bikes clattered to a halt. A female voice followed them around the corner.
Asshole!
He let another two intersections go by before he asked,
Where are we going? East at the moment. No, I mean, where are we? I know what you mean, Mr. Teague.
Eli looked over his shoulder.
Are they... Do you think we lost them? They're always following. It's just a question of how far behind they are.
He opened his mouth but closed it before any actual sounds came out. Harry looked back and cocked her head to listen for a few beats. Her shoulders dropped.
I think we may have done it, she said. I thought our goose was well and truly cooked when the second one showed up. I've never heard of anyone getting away from two of them.
Her feet shifted. The Model A slowed. The car still moved faster than the speed limit, but not so much it would gather more attention. Almost 2 minutes passed before she took another turn. Are you going to drop me off somewhere? She guided them past a gorgeous green 1970 Chevy Chevelle. The lanky driver blinked at them as they went by. Eli heard the muscle car's engine rev behind them. It sounded small after the roar of the Hornet. He cleared his throat.
Are you going to... I heard you the first time, Mr. Teague.
Sorry, he said.
You can call me Eli. I think it's best if we keep things formal for now, Mr. Teague.
Harry sighed.
As tempting as it is to leave you here, I can't do it.
Why?
Because they'd interrogate you and then kill you.
Ah.
If you were lucky, they'd kill you first. He managed a nervous laugh. Yeah, lucky me. Can't question a dead man, right? She glared at him. Of course they can, she said. Her attention shifted back to the road. It just doesn't hurt as much when they cut the answers out of you.
Eli tried to come up with a response, but it withered in his throat. She shook her head. The ponytail swished back and forth across her back.
I'm stuck with you, Mr. Teague.
10. They'd been driving for almost an hour. Harry had stayed off the highways. For the past 30 minutes, they'd been on a two-lane road which seemed to shift between residential areas and long stretches of plains or almost desert. If Eli's reading of the sun was correct, they were heading more or less northeast. It occurred to him he'd seen more types of terrain in the past week than he'd seen in the previous 29 years of his life. Cars zoomed up and swerved around them. Shiny sports cars, pickups, a U-Haul, minivans, even one big 16-wheeler. Harry seemed determined not to go over 65. Once Eli got used to reading the cylindrical speedometer, he realized how steady she'd kept their speed once they were out of Pasadena. So, he said. She glanced at him. She'd been giving him quick looks every few minutes, usually as she looked over her shoulder. Her expression shifted between sad and aggravated. She hadn't said much. When she did, it was just short, simple commands. Stop crowding her. A challenge on the tiny bench that made up the rumble seat. Brace for a turn. Adjust one of the mirrors. Eli knew a 1929 Model A shouldn't have side mirrors. Yet another upgrade. He wondered how many others the car had. So, he said again, is this all about the treasure hunt? Harry sighed.
In a manner of speaking, yes.
The guys with the faceless men. A dozen questions raced onto his tongue and tripped over one another. A dozen more pushed their way to the front of his mind.
That's what everyone calls them, she said when nothing else came. It's what they've always been called.
Always? She nodded.
Since the country was first founded.
Three new questions shoved themselves into his forebrain and knocked a random one off his tongue. What did you mean about their range? She reached up and tugged the point of her tricorn away from him, just an inch.
They're certain of everything within about 300 feet. Some of them a little more, some a little less.
What do you mean, certain?
Are you wearing stockings right now, Mr. Teague?
What?
Stockings. Socks.
Yeah, he said with a confused nod. She glanced at him, her eyes flitting away from the road.
You didn't check.
Yeah, but I know I am.
You're certain?
She said with another nod.
Just as you could be certain walking through a dark room you're familiar with. Just as they are. It's how they move. How they drive.
Her fingers flexed on the steering wheel.
How they aim.
So it's some kind of ESP? Telepathy or something? She shook her head.
It's just certainty.
But what is that? Harry glanced in the tiny side mirror and raised two fingers off the steering wheel, silencing him. Another engine rumbled up behind them. Eli waited to see the car rush past them, but it hung back. He looked over his shoulder through the oval rear window. A police cruiser followed a few car lengths behind them, a Dodge Charger with an aggressive-looking push bumper. It settled in and matched speeds with them. The morning sun splashed across the windshield and hid the officer, or officers.
"Consarn it,"
muttered Harry.
It might not mean anything, Eli said. Maybe he's just checking out the car. That's what worries me.
Eli tried to picture the Model A from behind as the officers would see it. A blank spot formed in the image.
Does your car have license plates?
Her chin went up once, then back down.
Yes.
Are they up to date?
Not precisely as such, no.
Eli fought the urge to glance back at the cruiser again.
How out of date are they?
Harry's fingers danced on the steering wheel as if she was counting. She glanced at the side mirror again.
7 decades, maybe 8?
7 decades? Red light flashed in the side mirror and the cruiser's sirens let out a squawk. Harry snarled.
Pull the car over,
a voice echoed behind them.
Hang on, she said. I'm going to make a run for it.
What?
If we can find a slick spot, we can lose him. It'll be tough out here, but... if we can make it to the next town.
He grabbed her arm.
Why are we running? He'll give you a warning or a ticket, and then we'll be gone anyway.
The faceless men sometimes use local law enforcement, she snapped, shaking him off.
The police could have orders to arrest us on sight.
They might not. They might just be...
The siren squawked again. Pull the car over now.
Harry glanced from Eli to the mirror. The Model A's engine rumbled. Eli braced his feet. The cruiser lunged up alongside them. The lights on the roof flashed in their eyes.
Now! Shouted the officer through the PA system.
Eli could see the figure in the passenger seat pointing emphatically at the highway's shoulder. Harry reached for the gear shift, but Eli touched her arm again.
They'll run us off the road, he said.
The cruiser's passenger wheels crossed the line. Its doors were inches from the Model A. The officer in the passenger seat pointed at the shoulder again. She glared at Eli, grumbled something he couldn't hear over the competing engines, and took her foot off the gas. The car slowed. The cruiser stayed alongside them until Harry angled the car into the dirt and gravel on the side of the road. It dropped back at the last moment to pull in right behind them. Doors opened. Feet crunched in the gravel. Eli glanced back and saw two officers with their hands on their guns, but neither of them had drawn. He looked at Harry and saw her feet poised over the pedals.
Just so you know, she said through gritted teeth, there's a good chance we're about to die.
What?
Try to act casual, Mr. Teague.
What do you mean, die?
The policeman walked forward and split to come up on either side of the car. The one by Harry stood tall enough that the Model A's roof hid his eyes and hat. Eli's was thick and heavy with a name tag that read, Foster.
Kill the engine, said the one by Harry. With one hand, he removed his sunglasses and hung them on his shirt pocket.
Harry glanced at Eli and pasted on a smile.
Of course, officer.
She reached out, flicked two switches, and the car's engine coughed itself to sleep.
Keys, he said with a nod at the steering column.
There are no keys in a Model T, officer,
she lied sweetly, moving her hands away from the column.
If I want to start it again, I'll need to get out and turn the crank from the magneto.
She gestured at the front of the car. The officer looked out at the hood, studied the small dashboard, and weighed the information for a moment.
License and registration,
he said. Not a question, just a simple command. Foster shifted next to Eli's door. The posture felt familiar from assorted run-ins with Zeke over the years. Two parts arrogance, one part excitement that he might get to pull his weapon. Eli hoped he was imagining it. Harry looked up at him.
Is there a problem?
The officer looked at her, then turned his head to look at the space behind the bench.
Why didn't you pull over when we instructed you to?
Harry took in a breath.
Well, you see...
That was my fault, officer,
interrupted Eli. He looked over and bent his head to make easy eye contact.
We're a little punchy from driving. I bet her she could outrun your charger for a mile.
The officer bent slightly to meet Eli's eyes.
That's extremely stupid. When an officer gives you a command, you do as he says.
I know, said Eli. I realized that pretty quick.
Not quick enough, said Foster with a snort. I hope the bet was worth it, said the other officer.
He shifted and the glare vanished from his name tag for a moment. Eli saw what looked like Lasney written on the little tile. Eli looked at Harry with what he hoped was a proper mix of regret and naughtiness.
It would have been.
Foster snorted again. Lasney's hand came off his pistol and he turned his attention back to Harry.
License and registration, ma'am.
Harry adjusted herself and tried to reach inside her coat and around to her back pockets. Eli pictured her pulling out one of her own pistols and shooting the policeman point blank. The officer must have thought of it too because he tensed and set his hand back on his pistol. But her hand came back empty and moved to reach into the coat at chest height. She blinked twice.
Oh,
she said.
Oh, my.
Lasney stared down at her. She switched hands and reached for the other side of the coat. Her eyes flitted to Eli.
Dearest,
she said,
have you seen my billfold?
Your wallet? You don't have it?
No, I can't find it anywhere.
It was a good performance, better than his. She patted herself down again. It was on the nightstand at the motel, said Eli. Her eyes widened. She looked back out at Lasney.
My apologies, officer,
she said.
I believe I've left it behind at the motel.
Lasney's mouth was a flat line. Registration?
Also in my billfold. Wallet.
You keep your car registration in your wallet?
Foster didn't bother to hide the sneer in his voice. Lasny shot him a look that confirmed Eli's suspicions about the other officer.
It's a classic, said Harry.
She reached out to pat the small dash and then gestured at all the open space between Eli's legs and the windshield.
There's no glove compartment.
Lasny blew some air out of his nose.
And if I was to ask for proof of insurance, ma'am?
She put up her hands and shrugged.
Also in the wallet. I'm so sorry.
The officer leaned back on his heels. The flat line of his mouth sank into a frown. He glanced at Eli.
What about you?
Sorry?
Got any ID? Or'd you leave your wallet at the hotel, too?
Harry caught Eli's eye just before he reached for his back pocket.
Sorry, no, he said.
I don't bring my license when she drives.
That's so.
To be honest, said Eli, I can't even drive this thing. It's her baby.
What's with the Civil War outfit?
Asked Foster. Eli stopped himself from rolling his eyes.
Revolutionary War, actually, he said.
So what's with it?
Car shows, said Eli. That's where we're going. Lots of people dress up to go with their car.
How's a Revolutionary War outfit go with a Model T? Asked Lasny.
I just like the outfit, Harry said. Besides, frock coats are always fashionable.
Lasny blew more air out of his nose. His trigger finger slid down and tapped the side of his leg just in front of his holster.
Where are you headed?
Like I said, Eli answered, a car show.
Where?
Las Vegas, he said, hoping they were aimed somewhat at Las Vegas. But first we'll have to double back to get my wallet, said Harry. We're lucky you stopped us, officer. We might have been stranded in Las Vegas with no money and no identification.
Lasny raised his head to look over the car at Foster. Eli guessed they were mouthing words to each other. Harry caught Eli's eye and gave a small shake of her head. Lasny tapped the Model A's roof twice.
Wait here, he said to them. Don't even think about starting the car, added Foster.
As I said before, Harry chimed, I can't start it without getting out to turn the crank.
The officer grunted. The two men took a few steps back behind the car and started talking. Eli leaned in to whisper, but Harry held up a finger. She turned her head, aiming her ear back. Her eyes closed. Eli glanced at the two officers through the rear window and tried to catch their words.
Old thing stinks, said Lasny.
Foster muttered something Eli half heard, half lip-read as, it's Zen. Lasny said something about probable cause and warrants. Foster shook his head again and spoke loud and clear.
They match the description.
Harry's eyes snapped open. She flicked two switches on the dashboard. The engine burped once and turned over.
Hey,
shouted Lasny. Eli glanced back as Harry floored it. The officer was in mid-stride toward them. Foster already had his pistol out and was moving to get a clear shot. The Model A lunged forward. The first gunshot missed, but Eli shrank down as the second one thunked into the car. A low gurgle came from the back.
Damnation, swore Harry. He's hit the reserve.
Then they were over a rise and out of sight. She worked the gears again and the Model A accelerated even more. Eli guessed they were close to top speed. She glanced at him crouching in the leg space.
While you're down there, Mr. Teague, she said, there's a small package in the door's side panel you could grab. Brown paper, red string.
He blinked and twisted around. What he thought was just a mass of crumpled paper for insulation turned out to be four or five small parcels with color-coded string. There were two with red string, each the size of a hardcover book.
Does it matter which one?
Harry glanced in the side mirror and shook her head.
Quickly, please.
The siren grew loud behind them. He pulled the packet free of the door and sat up. It shifted and bent in his hands as if loose chain links filled the paper bundle or a few of the cast-iron bar puzzles that showed up now and then at the tavern across from the bank.
What do I do with it? Throw it up on the roof.
What? He looked over his shoulder. The police cruiser was 200 yards away, tops and gaining fast.
Throw it onto the roof.
He reached up through the window with the package, balancing it on one hand. The wind whipped at his sleeve. The bag shifted on his fingers. She slapped his leg.
Throw it!
Eli tried to judge speed and height and then heaved the parcel into the air. It vanished from sight for an instant, and then he saw it through the back window tumbling away behind them.
Damn it! Perfect, said Harry.
The packet exploded on the pavement, already a good 30 feet behind them. Eli saw what looked like black crosses bounce and tumble on the road. Sunlight glinted on some of them. Then the Charger ran over them, and its front tires exploded. A moment later, the driver's side sagged in the back. The rims chewed through the rubber rags and sparked off the highway. Lasney or Foster, whoever was behind the wheel, steered into the slide like a pro. The police car crossed the far lane and came to a halt on the opposite shoulder in a cloud of dirt and dust. And then, the Model A was over a rise and the police vanished from sight. Eli settled back onto the bench and took a deep breath.
Oh, fuck.
Nicely done, Harry said.
What was that thing? The package?
Just a bag of 16-penny nails. A blacksmith bent them all at right angles, and a shipbuilder welded parts of them into stars so they'd land with a point up.
There's a word for those, Eli said. Those spike things that blow out tires. She nodded.
There is. I've forgotten it.
Me too,
said Eli. He looked over his shoulder.
Why didn't we use them before?
Before? When the faceless men were chasing us.
Harry snorted.
There'd be no point. They just dodged them.
You can't dodge 100 spikes on the road, not in a car.
They have certainty, Mr. Teague. You would be truly amazed at what it lets them do.
He shook his head and glanced back again as the Model A crested another low slope. He caught a glimpse of the distant police car and a stick figure moving around it. We should probably get off the road, maybe lay low for a while. They're probably on the radio right now setting up a roadblock or something. He waited for a reaction.
It means they can talk to other officers who are a long distance.
I know what a radio is, Mr. Teague.
He bit back his first response. Of course you do. Sorry. She glanced at him.
They can't tell other cars about us because it would attract attention. I'd wager they were told to avoid attention.
She dipped her head back over her shoulder.
One of them probably walked in, flashed his badge, and just gave instructions to whoever was on duty.
One of them, Eli repeated. By which you mean?
You know who I mean.
He sucked another deep breath in between his teeth.
What the hell are they?
Harry adjusted her fingers on the steering wheel. An orange light flickered twice on the dashboard and then lit up. Just below it, a small gauge bobbed up and down, back and forth between 1/4 and 0. It settled closer to 0.
I'll need fuel soon, she said.
She glanced at Eli. Okay, he said. Do you need me to chip in or something?
No.
Do you need gasoline in the car to tell me about the faceless men?
The car doesn't run on gasoline.
That's not really an answer. She bit back a sigh.
It's not a question that offers simple answers, Mr. Teague.
Maybe a quick summary? She glanced at him.
It's complicated.
He waved at the freeway ahead of them. We've got time to kill.
Very complicated.
Eli snorted. She looked ahead.
Let me find a safe place to refuel, she said, and I'll tell you what I know.
11. The Model A ate up another mile or two of desert highway. To Eli's eyes, most of the small signs seemed to be random numbers. Mile markers, he supposed. Local highway designations. The town clung low to the ground, like heat shimmering on pavement. At first, when it came into view in the distance, Eli mistook it for scattered slabs of rock covering the plain. As the Model A got closer and details accumulated, many of the buildings looked like mobile homes that had been converted into oblong cottages. Here and there, he spotted two trailers fused together. Low ranch-style houses and a few one-story brick buildings made up the rest of the town, maybe 50 structures in all, laid out in a crooked grid, with a decent amount of space around them. The sun had bleached every building to whites, grays, and faded tans. As the town drew closer, Eli could see the skeletal remains of half a dozen or so structures, like the remains of a bomb testing site or some half-forgotten war zone. The phone poles stood apart with no cables connecting them. One close to the freeway had a distinct lean to it.
Where are we?
Unless I'm mistaken, Harry said. That's the Nevada state line right over there.
She pointed at the far side of the plain, where a distant billboard-sized sign stood near the highway.
If you're asking about the town, I'm afraid I don't know its name off the top of my head.
The Model A crossed over a low bridge
Eli wouldn't have even noticed it except for the sign telling him he was crossing a river with a name he couldn't wrap his tongue around. At least half a dozen holes punctured the sign, the same kind of holes he saw all the time through the isolated signs of his own small town. He turned back and saw a thin stream of water a foot or two lower than the highway. It ran through a wide drain pipe under the pavement. The road bent, and Eli felt a shift. Momentum tugged his stomach to the left. A lifetime of New England winters made him tense as the wheel spun on the pavement for a few seconds. Harry twisted the steering wheel into the skid, and Eli felt the wheels grab, slip, and grab again. Then the Model A seized the road and continued toward the town. Eli twisted around to look at the road behind them. What did we hit?
Nothing.
No, I mean, what was on the road? She shook her head.
Nothing.
He sighed and settled back on the rumble seat. The pavement on this stretch looked dark and new. Lines hadn't even been painted on it yet. An oil patch would be almost invisible against the fresh asphalt. A few more details appeared as they closed in on the town. A small diner-style restaurant sat near the main road. A gas station stood next to it, still displaying the older red-orange circle logo with Gulf in dark blue letters. A moment later, he picked out a wooden sign that read Market on one of the brick buildings. Another one had a bright white mailbox out front. A black car with huge tail fins pulled into the gas station ahead of them. Eli tried to get a better look at the front because the rear window and taillights made him think it might be a 1959 Cadillac coupe in gorgeous condition. He knew old cars lasted better in drier climates, but the Caddy looked amazing. You just passed the gas station.
I am aware of that.
Do you think there'll be another one in a town this size?
Help me find a church, said Harry, ignoring the question. Or maybe a house that looks like no one's home.
His gaze drifted up an approaching phone pole. Three wires stretched across the arms at the top, mere threads against the blue sky. He glanced back, couldn't spot the leaning pole, and wrote it off as an optical illusion caused by the surrounding hills. The town made a much better impression up close than it did at a distance. About 30 or 40 years out of date, but it still looked pretty nice. It probably wasn't that different from Sanders, Eli realized. There were people on the streets, a few carried bags, one had a briefcase. Most of them glanced at the Model A as it drove by, but it held the attention of only a few, and even those for just a few seconds. A powder blue car passed them, and Eli craned his head to follow it. The driver noticed and gave a polite smile and nod.
I think that was a 58 Edsel Corsair, Eli said. Focus, Mr. Teague.
He cleared his throat. We're looking for a church?
Please.
Do you remember the time we met at the church, back in Sanders?
Of course I do, she said. It wasn't that long ago for me, barely 2 months.
Eli gestured out at the Model A's hood. You were working on the engine.
And you were looking down my shirt.
Well, his tongue fumbled in his mouth. I didn't mean to. I was 13, and I didn't even know you were a girl. A woman. She shook her head.
Oh, Mr. Teague, you silver-tongued devil.
He sighed and shook his head.
You told me the car ran on water, that it had a Garrett carburetor.
She nodded.
Yes.
Yes, that's what you said?
Yes to all of it.
Eli shook his head again.
The Garrett carburetor is an urban legend. An urban legend with a U.S. patent. The patent doesn't mean anything, he said. His design doesn't work. Well, then I guess Eleanor doesn't work either.
The car's name is Eleanor?
Yes.
Why?
Because that's what her original owner named her. He saw it in a motion picture.
So how does Eleanor have a working Garrett carburetor? Harry pointed at a house that looked like a poor man's attempt to copy a craftsman home.
No one's cut that lawn in almost a month, she said. Almost a dozen newspapers between the porch and driveway. Someone's out of town.
Or lazy. Harry smirked.
I've done this once or thrice before. You get a feel for lazy over absent.
She circled the block, but when they came up on the house again, there was a man in a white hat and retro cardigan walking a small dog. They drove past, and the terrier crouched on the front lawn between two tall dandelions. The man yawned and looked at his watch.
Definitely no one home, Harry said as they circled the block again. Might even be a bad house.
Maybe he just hates his neighbor?
Harry shook her head.
If he thought he was getting away with something, he'd be watching out to make sure he does get away with it. He didn't even notice this fine automobile driving by.
Yeah, murmured Eli. His eyes stayed on the 1959 Dodge Lancer parked in the driveway next door. They circled around a third time. The man with the dog was at the far end of the block. A woman across the street and two houses down emptied a mailbox. Harry's chin dipped approvingly, and she pulled into the driveway. She was out of the car before the engine stopped rattling.
Open the tank for me, please, Mr. Teague,
she called over her shoulder. Her coat fluttered behind her as she strode over to the loose coil of rubber.
Dust and cobwebs,
she said, pointing at the hose.
It's a bad house, as I said.
Eli opened the door. And that's good? He slid out the door and reached across the hood for the gas cap. It popped off in his hand and he glanced at the rubber seal. Definitely aftermarket.
Good for me.
Harry pulled 3, 4, 5 loops of the hose off its bracket and twisted the valve. The house's guts groaned, burped twice, and then spat out some rust-red liquid. The splashing stream mixed with the silt and dirt on the driveway and became a thin mudslide that raced in 4 different directions. She watered the lawn while the hose ran clear. Another car approached, a big 4-door Mercury with double headlights and a hardtop. The driver locked eyes with Eli, but drove on by. Eli took in a breath through his nose, then a second, deeper one through his mouth. The air smelled different. The tang of car exhaust and gasoline trailing behind the Mercury seemed stronger, but the air itself seemed fresher. He wondered if the desert climate kept things separate somehow. A black and white squad car rolled by down the street and drove the pleasant thoughts from his head. They stayed gone even after Eli recognized it as an old Ford Fairlane, maybe a 61. Eli glanced back. You sure it's safe to be sitting here like this out in the open? What if those cops called ahead?
They didn't,
she said, dragging the hose to the Model A. What if they call ahead to the local station? She shoved the hose into the tank.
They won't.
It rang and thrummed and sang as the water churned inside it. Harry closed her eyes and focused on the sound. He walked back to the Model A.
So, he said, guys with no faces.
Yes,
she said without opening her eyes. Who can order police around?
Yes.
Do I need to actually ask questions before you'll answer anything?
She opened one eye.
Yes.
Eli rolled his eyes.
Come on!
Harry opened her other eye.
I'll warn you now, Mr. Teague, I may not be able to give you a satisfying answer. Most of what I know is more of, well, stories and general ideas that have been passed along from one searcher to the next.
She paused to tap the top of the hood and listened to the drumbeat of the gas tank.
My old partner taught me a lot of it, but most of it was what he'd learned from the woman who'd taught him. It's like a childhood game of secrets where he whispers to me, I whisper to you, you whisper to someone else, but the story changes a little bit every time.
Telephone game, Eli said. I remember playing that when I was a kid.
Harry nodded.
There's a great deal to tell, but it's all second and third-hand knowledge at best, so, as I said, it doesn't lend itself to simple explanations.
She nodded toward the rear of the vehicle.
Would you check the reserve, please, Mr. Teague? I believe it took a shot.
He sighed and walked around the car. I still want answers.
You'll get them.
A few drops fell from the base of the red gas can to a puddle under the Model A. Eli ran his fingers across the plastic surface and found the puncture about 2/3 of the way down. The tip of his pinky could just fit into the hole. Yeah, he called out. It caught a... He glanced up and down the street. It got hit. Harry muttered to herself.
Straight through?
Eli checked. Looks like... He crouched down and peered through. A moment or two of lining up through the gas can showed him a small dimple and a scratch on the Model A's dark blue finish. Yeah, clean through. Looks like the water slowed it down a lot, though. Barely dented the car. She muttered again.
What? I said we'll have to patch it for now.
The tail-finned caddy drove past, heading home from the gas station. Eli admired its lines, then found his eyes drifting to one of the small homes.
I didn't know they still made towns like this.
From your point of view, they don't.
What's that mean?
She didn't answer. He walked a few paces back toward the house, his leg muscles flexed and tingled, thanking him now, warning him it would hurt later. He reached for his toes, his hamstrings quivered, and then he stretched back to look up at the house. Dust and cobwebs didn't just cover the hose, they covered the whole structure. Gray strands rounded every corner of the porch and roof, every window frame and door frame. A fine coat of gray dulled each pane of glass and fixture. The house wasn't just unoccupied, it was mummified. Eli took a few more steps and peered in through the window. A wooden chair stood a few feet out from the wall. A piece was missing from its elaborate back. A square cardboard box with sagging corners sat by the room's lone door. An empty bookshelf stood against one wall. Not entirely empty, he realized. A handful of books lay flat on the various shelves, camouflaged with years of gray dust. Something sprawled on the floor, halfway between the box and the chair, not quite at the center of the room. His first thought was a bundle of clothes, blanketed with more cobwebs and dust. Then he saw the bones and decided it was an animal that had gotten trapped in the house somehow and died. Maybe a large cat or a raccoon. But the skull looked very round for an animal, and very large for the body. Harry set a hand on his shoulder.
Best to not look inside, Mr. Teague. These places accumulate history, rarely the good kind.
I think that might be...
It's long dead, whatever it is, she said.
Her hand patted his shoulder, just a faint tap, and she stepped back to the chugging hose.
He looked through the window at the tiny skeleton. It was in plain sight, right by one of the main windows. He could see faint footprints in the dust all around it. Some looked like shoes, others like paws.
Shouldn't we tell someone?
About what?
Eli gestured at the window.
Harry raised an eyebrow.
Do you think nobody knows?
Well, Eli looked at the town, then back over his shoulder. Shouldn't we tell the police?
In a town this size, I'm sure some local deputy checks in on empty buildings at least once or twice a month.
So why haven't they done anything?
Because they don't want to know,
she said.
Or maybe they already know and they just want to avoid confirming it. Whatever that is in there, it's been there for years, at least. Perhaps decades.
Eli looked at her face. Her expression reminded him of his mother or a teacher trying to explain some basic truth that just wasn't being understood. Boredom mixed with acceptance, seasoned with sadness, dusted with a few grains of annoyance. Harry must have seen her reflection in his eyes. Her face softened.
It's a bad house,
she said.
Pretty much every town has one. One of the darker side effects of the dream.
The dream?
Yes.
He waited for her to continue. Instead, she walked back to the car, swung the red tank from its bracket, and pulled her toolbox from the trunk.
I just need a few minutes to putty the reserve, she said, and then we'll be on our way.
I thought you were going to explain the faceless men.
We're getting there, Mr. Teague, I promise.
Eli sighed, stepped over the hose toward the door, and then changed course. He kicked one of the rolled-up newspapers around so he could read the headline. Even the top one had the brittle look of newsprint that had been exposed to the elements for weeks, maybe months. The banner named it the Herald Republican, established in 1938, which left Eli wondering if Herald referred to the paper itself or the name of the town. There didn't seem to be a single main headline, but according to the largest one, the president had announced a budget surplus of over $1 billion, which didn't seem terribly noteworthy, even to Eli's dim understanding of government spending. Then he caught the first words of the article. In an official announcement in Washington, President Eisenhower declared a budget surplus of... Eli's eyes jumped back up to the banner, and the date below it. July 20, 1960. He glanced back at Harry, thumbing some kind of gummy material into the hole in the gas can, then at the Dodge Lancer parked across the road. He tried to remember seeing a single car from the 70s or later. Since they came into town. He'd been distracted by all the classics, but there must have been one. He looked down the road where the man in the hat and cardigan had gone with his dog. He walked back to Harry.
Where are we?
She stopped blowing on the patch, a yellow, clear goop that filled the hole. It already seemed hard.
We're about a mile and a half from the Nevada border.
That's not what I mean.
She blew on the patch again before flipping the plastic tank around.
Then say what you mean, Mr. Teague. No sense pussyfooting about it.
He stared at her, then at the Lancer. Are we in 1960? Harry shrugged and thumbed a wad of putty into the exit hole.
Mid-1960s, she said. Possibly early 1966, but I don't think so.
You don't think so? She shook her head, then packed a wrinkled tube of something chemical-smelling back into her toolbox. She stood up and blew on the patch one more time. Eli smelled the air again, looked back at the papers.
How?
She sighed and closed the trunk.
That question covers a great deal of ground.
We traveled through time?
Through history, yes.
When?
That's a bit of a brain teaser, isn't it?
Harry carried the gas can over to the hose, swinging it back and forth through the air. Eli followed at a safe distance.
Shouldn't there have been a flash of light or a tunnel or a, I don't know, something?
Do you recall the tires skidding as we approached town?
He nodded.
That was it. That was when we slipped back.
How? He asked again.
How will take a little more to explain.
She stuck the hose into the gas can and cranked the spigot again. Water sloshed into the container.
Can you just give me a simple version?
I'm sorry, Mr. Teague, but no. This may be difficult to believe, but the mechanisms of traveling through history defy simple explanation.
He looked at her, back at the newspaper, then back at the gleaming Lancer in the driveway across the street. The street in the small desert town that had looked old and abandoned when they'd approached, before the skid.
Holy shit, he said. I mean, I kinda knew. I figured it out after the second time we met, but I still didn't really, I mean, we actually did it. We're in the past.
Yes,
Harry said, pulling the hose free.
It's very exciting.
She watered the driveway a bit more while twisting the spigot off. She tapped the dried plug on each side of the gas can, nodded, and heaved the plastic can up to her hip. Eli reached to help, but she turned away and lugged the reserve back to the Model A. He followed behind her. She lined up the tank, heaved again, and dropped it into the bracket. Its weight made the car bounce once. The dream, Eli said again.
Yes.
Back when I was a kid, you said you had to see a man about a dream. She nodded once and pulled a strap across the plastic tank.
Is that the thing you're looking for?
The dream? Harry met his eyes.
Yes,
she said.
I'm one of many people searching for it.
For what?
She rested her hands on the red container, her back to him.
You've asked about a lot of things, she said. My search, history, travel, the faceless men. What you don't realize is that, in truth, these are all related questions about the same thing.
She looked at him and waited.
The dream, said Eli.
Yes. What do you know about history?
Do you mean the Middle Ages or the Renaissance or
American history? How the United States began?
Eli's mind flitted back through grade school and high school and the half-dozen college classes that had earned him a minor. There'd also been some casual independence studies into clothing and fashion, trying to learn more about the woman he'd last seen when he was 13. The history of automobiles had been his main focus.
More than the basics, he guessed. Still less than a lot of people, I guess.
Words of warning, she said. Much of what I'm going to tell you will go against what you've learned. Not just in history, but in many disciplines. Some of it's just going to be unbelievable. But it's all true.
Okay.
We should get going.
Going where? When?
East, for now. I'll explain everything as we go.
Thanks.
He stood there in the driveway, his gaze flitting from the cars, to the houses, to the fresh pavement. The corners of her mouth flexed.
Get in the car, Mr. Teague. The road beckons.
Harry flipped the ignition switches. The Model A shuddered, and they backed out of the Bad House's driveway. As they headed back out of the town, Eli caught a quick glimpse of the dog walker heading into the small market and someone at the gas station with a blocky red Chevy pickup. Then the highway was under their tires again, and the Model A, Eleanor, picked up a little more speed.
12. It had been dumb luck that Officer Zeke Miller had been there at the desk that day. Wednesday was supposed to be his day off, but Captain Deacon had come down with a bad case of food poisoning. It meant double shifts to pick up the slack. Goddamn perfect Barney ended up on patrol, and Zeke got called in to man the station's phones and radio, which was the most boring part of the job, especially in a town like Sanders. The man on the phone had introduced himself as Agent 15 and rattled off a badge number to confirm his authority. He asked for the senior officer on duty. Zeke introduced himself. Agent 15 had been looking for a dangerous fugitive, an insurgent. According to him, she'd been seen in Sanders. Zeke had found this hard to believe. One, that any kind of major league fugitive would be in Sanders. Two, that a woman could be all that dangerous. There were hot kick-ass women in movies and stuff, sure, but that was all pretend. 15 had assured Zeke the woman, Harriet Pritchard, was dangerous. However, the agent already had a man dealing with her. He needed Zeke to keep an eye on her accomplice in town. He'd asked if Zeke knew of a man named Elias Teague. Zeke knew him all right, and had said so. He'd known Eli Teague pretty much his whole life. 15 said this was good and had asked Zeke to keep an eye on Eli until further notice. That had been last week. Now Zeke sat at the station's front desk and glared at that same phone. He'd glared at everything for the past few days. He snapped another pencil. Then he snapped the two pieces. He put his thumbs against the short, stubby remains and managed to break three of them. He couldn't get leverage on the fourth. Barney had been on the phones when Zeke had shown up for his shift. Goddamn perfect Barney. 2 years ago, Zeke would have thought a man named Barney would need brick balls to be a small-town police officer. Barneys were solid marble all the way through. A walking Greek statue, the people of Sanders called him. He transferred up from York Beach with glowing recommendations. Zeke didn't get along with him. They'd exchanged a few basic courtesies. Barney offered some news on Captain Deacon and mentioned a few items in the logbook. Then he grabbed his coat and headed for the door for a night patrol. And Zeke had settled in behind the desk. The desk where he'd be for the next 59 nights. After he'd questioned Nicole about Eli's disappearance, she had called Deacon with a bunch of exaggerated stories about intimidation and police brutality. It was all lies. She didn't have any bruises. She was just an uppity bitch who'd had it in for Zeke since he broke up with her in high school. And yeah, he'd kicked in the door to Eli's crap little apartment above Tanner's garage. He'd been chasing a fugitive. Time was of the essence in all that shit. He couldn't wait for a search warrant. His only real mistake had been keeping Agent 15's call to himself and not telling Deacon about it. Now, half the town turned against Zeke. Just that morning, getting off work, he'd heard whispers at the grocer when he stopped in to get a coffee and a knockoff McMuffin. Robin Ferber talking with Thatcher behind the counter about how Eli was too responsible to just up and leave without saying anything. Everyone knew that. They'd clammed up when they saw Zeke. But they weren't the only ones. Everybody in town kept wondering what had really happened to Eli. The fact that he'd asked his boss at Stallbank for a few days off didn't matter. Everybody gave Zeke the eye, like he was some kind of movie maniac with an axe or something, like he'd done something. At least Deacon was a fair man. He'd said it didn't look good, but he wouldn't be the one to start a witch hunt. Zeke just wasn't going out on patrol for 2 months, or dealing with the day traffic in the office. 2 months, manning the phones and radio every night for the next 59 nights and counting. Rookies, cripples, and old men did desk duty. He was young and strong at the peak of his game. Like they said about star quarterbacks, he should be out keeping the town safe with Barney, not sitting in the station, especially at night. Zeke left the desk and stomped around the office, his left hand flexed, open and closed, open and closed, open and closed. They only got 3 or 4 calls a night, and at least 2 of those were always that old fossil Mr. Moreland, calling to complain about barking dogs or a loud car driving by his house or someone walking by outside. Late shift on the desk equaled punishment, no question about it. Zeke glared at the wanted posters. A collection of losers the Stadies were looking for, plus 3 or 4 from the FBI. The real smart criminals almost never got wanted posters. One of the teachers at the academy had told him that. These people backed it up. A bank robber. A few aggravated assaults. One attempted murderer. A car thief from Ogunquit. Seriously, who was stupid enough to steal cars anymore with all the alarms and stuff? Eli's picture should be up on the board, Zeke realized. It needed to be. Eli was a fugitive. He'd aided and abetted. Andy was an asshole who'd been making Zeke's life suck since 3rd grade, whining about every joke or noogie or dodgeball that came his way. Every Monday morning, Deacon cleaned the whole board off, sorted in the new posters, and put them all back in alphabetical order. He tacked them up. Real tacks, the flat metal ones, not plastic pushpins. Zeke entertained the idea of rearranging the posters now to make space for Eli's poster. This was a federal matter, after all. That's what the voice on the phone had said. There'd be a poster. He imagined himself prying at the tacks, wedging his nails under them and pulling until they slid out of the corkboard. He could have the board stripped in 20 minutes, put back together in maybe half an hour. Eli's poster would go in the bottom row, but if Zeke swapped it with the FBI most wanted guy, Quilt, that'd put Eli up at the end of the 2nd row. It was a good spot. Visible as soon as someone walked into the station. Maybe they'd get extras of the Eli poster, since he was local. Or he could make copies. Some wanted posters only named the one big crime somebody was wanted for, but hopefully Eli's would list everything.
Hello, Officer Miller.
Zeke spun around and reached for his sidearm. People should know better than to sneak up on a cop. If they wet their pants at the business end of a Smith & Wesson, well, that's how people learn to respect the uniform. But he was on punishment, desk duty. And Sanders, that meant his holster was empty. A shotgun sat in a quick-release mount behind the counter for emergencies, but right now, behind the counter, wasn't the side he was on. All this rushed through his mind as Zeke registered the man standing behind him. Just a few feet behind him, he hadn't made a sound coming into the station or walking across the small lobby. The tall man wore a dark suit with a matching hat like in Dragnet or one of those shows about people back in the 60s. He had one hand in his coat, and Zeke's thoughts went back to the shotgun as the hand came out holding a leather square. The wallet flipped open to reveal an elaborate silver badge with gold details and a glossy red, white, and blue inlay. Zeke registered the letters U.S. and Department of something that began with D before the man snapped the badge holder shut with a casual display of badassery.
I'm 15, said the man.
All the sharp edges were gone from the man's voice, like his words were coming through a handkerchief or scarf.
We spoke on the phone the other day.
Zeke's mind cleared, and he remembered the call and the agent. Then he remembered Eli had ruined any chance to look impressive on the federal level. Zeke bit back his anger and stuck out his hand.
Good to meet you in person, sir.
15 looked down at the hand, and for a second Zeke thought the agent was going to leave him hanging. Then the man reached out and closed his fingers around Zeke's. He had a strong grip, not in a macho, ass-hat, scoring-points way, a solid, dependable grip. He pumped Zeke's hand twice, then released it.
I've come to hear your report on Eli Teague.
Zeke's survival sense awoke in the back of his mind and crept forward.
My report?
The tall man pulled a long, old-fashioned notepad from inside his suit jacket.
You were instructed to keep Mr. Teague under surveillance, to make sure he didn't leave Sanders.
Zeke's stomach flopped. His survival sense growled, warned him this conversation was a bad place to be.
Hey,
and yet 2 days after you and I spoke, Mr. Teague was seen in Boston, speaking with a known collaborator of our fugitive, one often used to pass supplies and messages between insurgent groups.
Look, I did the best I could. I tried to keep an eye on him, like you said, but he's a sneaky bastard, always has been.
So you knew this, but still didn't take precautions to stop him from getting away?
A statement, not a question. Zeke had heard things phrased this way many times in his life, by his parents, his teachers, his assorted bosses, always with that same tired but not surprised tone. Something settled over Zeke. His skin tingled. His pulse slowed. The noise that always cluttered his mind cleared away. Even his growling survival sense quieted itself. The word epiphany would mean nothing to him, but on some primal level, Zeke understood this was a major moment in his life. The next few minutes would have a profound effect on everything that happened afterward. He needed to be straight and come clean and not spray his usual stream of protective bullshit over everything. No, he said. No, I didn't. I didn't know what he was going to do because I was just thinking of him as some wuss from school who was pounding my ex, you know? I wasn't seeing the big picture. He paused for a moment. I wasn't given all the information so I could see the big picture. Maybe if I'd known what was really going on, I could have done my job better, but I did the best I could with what I had. The agent seemed to consider this. As he did, Zeke noticed the mask the man wore. A transparent one with eyebrows and cheeks and lips painted on the plastic. Probably some special government-issue thing. It seemed weird he hadn't noticed it before, but maybe that was the point of it. It made it hard to pick out the details of the agent's face. 15 had his eyes closed behind the mask, like he was thinking. He stood rock still. It was almost as if he'd started daydreaming. He turned his head toward the wanted posters.
Are you a citizen of the United States, Officer Miller?
Zeke twitched. It had only been 8 or 9 seconds of silence, but the agent's voice startled him all over again, like it was coming from nowhere, even though the man was right in front of him.
What?
2 fingers flipped the notebook closed.
It's a simple question. I need to make sure before we continue.
Zeke nodded. Yeah? I'm 100% American. All the way back to my great-great-grandpa. My family's been in Sanders almost the whole time.
Were you born here?
It was a we're-all-friends-here question, one to keep him at ease. Yeah, well, Wentworth Douglas down in Dover. It was the closest hospital. 15 gave 2 slow nods. Zeke had to admit the whole mask thing was a little creepy. Now that he was really looking at it, it looked like one of the cheap-ass masks they sold at CVS around Halloween or the big costume stores that opened over in New Hampshire every September. He'd seen people wear those a few times, once when some losers had tried to rob the Cumberland Farms store on the south side of town. They didn't hide shit. This one, though, blurred all the agent's features, so the only thing Zeke could see was skin tone.
Definitely some kind of government-issue thing. I would like to offer you,
15 said,
an opportunity for personal advancement.
What?
The agent slid his notebook back into his coat, pulled out a white square, and the big man was 3 steps closer, pressing the square over Zeke's nose and mouth. Zeke tried to slam the hand away, but it was like hitting a heavy bag at the gym. Something sharp burned his eyes as something sweet tickled his nose and throat.
Congratulations, officer,
15 said as the lights dimmed.
You've been selected for service.
13. A few miles rolled by under Eleanor's wheels.
On the dashboard, the rotating cylinder drifted back and forth between 60 and 65 miles per hour. The broad, flat desert stretched out around them, marked here and there by distant hills. Harry drummed her fingers on the steering wheel again. She did it a lot. For a while, Eli tried humming different songs under his breath to see if anything lined up with the beat of her fingers. Classic rock, pop stuff, country, movie themes, even a few children's songs he remembered from grade school. Whatever she tapped to was either very obscure or completely random. A mile marker approached them and flashed by.
Back in 1764, Harry said, keeping her eyes on the road, a group of British colonials became frustrated with the Empire. With their lack of representation in their own government, Britain had a parliament at this point, but the American colonists had very little say in it.
And taxes, said Eli. They were upset about taxes.
Not as much as you'd think. It wasn't the tax itself. They understood the need for it. And taxes were actually quite low at the time. People simply didn't like having no say in when it was levied or how it was used. Effectively, they felt like they were being oppressed by foreigners, that they were a country ruled by Britain rather than part of Britain. And with several of them, this notion took root, that the American colonies were a separate country.
The cadence of her voice shifted, relaxed. The words came out at a comfortable, practiced pace.
The idea grew, and eventually it occurred to them that they could be a separate country, that they could declare independence.
Eli nodded again.
Looking back with the benefit of history, Harry continued, this seems pretty straightforward. It's what you and I grew up with and were taught in school.
Wait, said Eli. You were taught this in school?
Of course.
His eyes went up and down her colonial outfit. She looked at him for a moment, then understood.
I was born in 1885, Mr. Teague. I just like the coat.
Her fingers flexed on the steering wheel.
But we're getting off point. Don't interrupt.
Sorry.
As I was saying, independence seems like a straightforward idea in hindsight. At the time, though, this was revolutionary. In several ways, nothing like this had happened before. Oh, conquered countries had rebelled, overthrown their rulers, and reasserted themselves. Stolen lands had been stolen back or abandoned to the original owners. But for a colony, an established extension of a country, to just declare itself independent, it simply didn't happen. It hadn't happened in hundreds of years of colonial expansion.
I know all this, Eli said, more or less.
I'm setting the stage, so to say.
Harry leaned on the steering wheel and the Model A followed a curve in the road, around a tall, rust-red hill.
It's one thing for a group of educated aristocrats and upper class to come to this conclusion, but how do you get the farmers and merchants and blacksmiths behind this idea? Keep in mind, many of them were only four or five generations away from feudalism. The idea of nations overall, let alone declaring independence from one of the oldest empires on the planet, was simply beyond them.
That's silly, said Eli. People weren't stupid back then.
They weren't,
she agreed.
I've met many of them. But you're looking at it with hindsight again. It seems simple and straightforward to you and me, but they lacked the proper framework.
So they had to come up with a great sales pitch,
said Eli.
And they did.
Not precisely. They did have a...
Harry worked the term on her tongue.
A sales pitch. Thomas Paine and others continued to push the idea of unfair taxes, but again, most people were used to the idea of unfairness and taxes. They accepted it as a simple truth of the world.
So what did they do?
She let another half mile slip past them.
They created a dream.
He waited a moment, then waved her on.
They needed something to inspire people,
Harry explained.
For the citizens to rally behind and believe in, something which could be the base for their whole idea of a fledgling nation. And Benjamin Franklin came up with the idea of forging a dream.
Eli shifted his jaw from side to side.
Okay.
She took another breath.
Franklin was a scholar and a high-ranking Freemason. While he was in Europe, he used his status as a Grand Master to gain access to certain historical documents and religious texts. With these, he designed a ritual, a conjuration of sorts. When he returned to the Americas in 1775, he gathered some of the founding fathers from other lodges to perform it with him. They summoned Ptah, the Egyptian god of creation, the blacksmith god, and they came to an accord, which resulted in him forging a dream for them. The American dream.
She glanced at his face. Eli stared back at her. Another sign appeared on the road ahead. It rushed forward, passed, and vanished behind them. He never registered what it said.
You can't be serious, he said.
I can't say if it's the precise gospel truth. I can only say it's how the story came down the chain to me.
That's ridiculous. Every part of it is nonsense.
It's all true.
Want to throw Santa and the Easter Bunny in there?
Don't be absurd, Mr. Teague.
Absurd? He shook his head. The Freemasons aren't some mystic cult. They're a service organization like the Shriners or Rotary Club. I did night shifts at the Cumberland Farms down in South Berwick every summer through college. They'd stop in all the time after meetings.
Even as he said it, Eli pictured the line of rumpled businessmen showing up one after another to buy convenience store coffee or gasoline.
A service organization which goes back thousands of years, she said. One that many of the founding fathers happened to belong to.
He shook his head.
It's nonsense.
She shrugged.
You're saying the American dream is an actual physical thing?
Yes.
It's an actual thing that a group of Freemasons had a god make for them so they could convince everyone in the country to leave England?
That's the gist of it, yes.
He stared out at the desert. The shadows of hills and stones and lumpy cacti stretched longer as the sun sank behind them.
That's completely nuts.
And yet,
she said,
like the Garrett carburetor, still true.
Eli crossed his arms. The Model A ate up another mile of highway with its tires before he spoke again.
So, the whole American Revolution happened because of an Egyptian god?
Such a silly idea, I know,
said Harry.
If it was true, there'd be giant obelisks in the nation's capital, pyramids on the currency, noticeable things like that.
Eli opened his mouth to respond, then shut it. Is this dream in Washington? He asked half a mile later.
I don't think so, no.
Philadelphia?
No.
Where is it? Can we go see it? She shook her head.
I'm afraid not.
Why not?
Because no one knows where it's gone. It was stolen from the place it was kept. I'm searching for it. Many people are.
Right, he said. You're all searching for the American dream. He rubbed his eyes.
I did tell you it was a lot to take in all at once, and we've barely scratched the surface.
How? He started. The sentence died after the one word.
Why do you... Did you make all of this up?
Of course not.
She frowned and gave him a disappointed look.
So where's it all coming from? Where did you hear this?
She sighed and focused on the road.
Around. Down the chain. The person who brought me into the search told me most of it.
Most of it?
People talk. They trade information.
So all of this is just stories you've heard?
Not just stories. People have been observing and testing this for hundreds of years.
Hundreds?
Yes, hundreds. We travel in history, Mr. Teague. We've spent more years searching for the dream than the country's actually existed.
How's that even possible?
It's a big country,
she said,
with a lot of history behind it. If you're going for square footage, it has an amazing amount of history for such a relatively young nation.
How long have you been searching for it? She glanced at him.
Just over 9 years.
He blinked. How old are you?
A gentleman shouldn't ask such a thing of a lady.
I don't think I'm much of a gentleman, said Eli. And I'm really getting the sense you're not much of a lady.
And there's that wit again.
My point is, you can't be much older than me.
I turn 30 in a few months,
she said.
More or less.
More or less?
It's hard to keep track when you don't see the months in order. I may be 30 already. No more than that, though. Maybe just 29?
She glanced away from the road to meet his eyes.
I was 19 when I first went on the road.
That's young.
Old for the time I was raised. I had friends who were married at 18. My parents were worried I'd be an old maid.
Eli let a mile go by, and then another. So, you're searching for the American dream? Harry nodded.
Yes.
And the car, Eleanor, is a time machine, like in Back to the Future.
What?
He waved a hand at the dashboard. Is that what all the switches are, controls or something?
That's the ignition. I don't want to risk losing a key, and we... I needed some way to safeguard her against hijacking.
So Eleanor is...
Just a car. With some modifications to the engine and the ignition.
But it travels through time. Her head bobbed back and forth.
The car travels through history, yes,
she said.
But we're not traveling through history because of the car, if that makes sense.
Not really. Her fingers tapped out another verse of something on the wheel.
You can put on fancy shoes and run,
she said.
But the shoes aren't making you run. You aren't running solely because you're wearing the shoes.
I think I'm still missing something. She nodded slowly, and Eli could sense her organizing thoughts as the Model A covered more distance.
Have you ever heard people talk of a town or part of a city that's, say, stuck in the 1950s or the 1920s or the last century? Sayings like that.
Yeah, of course.
Well, sometimes, more times than you'd think, they are.
They are...
Stuck. Trapped in history. A road or a neighborhood or a whole town where it's still 1950 or 1920 or 1875.
You mean they never developed?
I mean they never left. History slipped past them and they're still stuck in 1950. It's been 1950 there for decades. You see, the dream was intended to allow people's hopes and beliefs to become true. It allows people to live how they want. In some cases, it can even reshape the world.
How?
For the sake of argument,
she explained, back on familiar ground.
Let us say a great number of people believe the same thing, that this town or that era is the pinnacle of how things should always be. The mindsets, the culture, the technology, they believe this is a moment which defines the very best of America. Or, in a few rare cases, the very worst of it.
Okay.
When enough of these people get together, their belief focuses the dream, and it makes these things so. That point is pinned down and stuck, while the rest of history moves on past it, or piles up around it, really. That's what the dream does in these places,
Harry said.
It brings things to a halt. The people there decide they don't want things to change, so they don't.
She paused to glance at him.
These are the slick spots, the places we can skid across history.
Eli looked out at the desert. The sun was on the horizon behind them. Shadows covered most of the landscape, broken by a few fierce slashes of daylight. When we drove into the town yesterday, he said, the car skidded on the road. The corners of Harry's mouth twitched.
Not on the road, on history. As I said, the dream has created hundreds and hundreds of slick spots all over the country. You just need to know how to spot them. And if you know where these slick spots are, if you get a feel for them, you can use them, go through them. Sometimes slingshot around them for a bit of momentum, so to speak. And they can take you any when in America's history.
Any when?
Well, within certain limits. Geographically, the late 1700s is all the East Coast. Then there's the Louisiana Purchase, which opens up a lot of territory for us. No Texas until the end of 1849, and no California until 1850. Alaska's a little tricky because it's not connected, but I know a few folks who've done it.
What about Hawaii?
There aren't any roads to Hawaii. Don't be foolish, Mr. Teague.
Right, he said. Foolish.
A few spots are very specific,
she explained.
There's a street in Dallas that only leads to November of 1963, and a bus route in Montgomery that goes to December of 1955. A road in Philadelphia will take you to August of 1776. Others are more general and give a little more elbow room once you become skilled at driving them. Washington, D.C. is filled with them, of course. There's a sort of sweet spot that crops up often across the country, from 1945 to 1957, and that's useful. The decade of ultimate, unchallenged American superiority, from some people's view.
What happened in 1957?
Sputnik. Absolute proof another country was ahead of the United States. Kicked the legs out from under a lot of people.
They drove for a few minutes without speaking. The pavement hummed under Eleanor's tires. The engine purred in its coarse way. Harry cleared her throat.
It took me a week to get my mind around it, even when Christopher, my old partner, showed me the roads. I was convinced it was a trick.
It's kind of familiar, actually, he said. She blinked.
Really?
Eli nodded. I took a couple science classes in college. Didn't really want to, but I needed them for requirements, so I tried to find the fun ones, and one of them was an astronomy course.
Navigation?
He managed to chuckle. Not exactly. Not really my thing, but some of it was interesting. Harry turned her head to look at him, to judge him.
You failed the course.
No, he said. I passed. Barely. She snorted. He used his hands to sketch a plane between him and the windshield. Later in the semester, the professor talked about how light and gravity and time and space were all related. He had this really great diagram of space, a huge gridded plane, and all the stars made these sort of depressions in space. Their gravity bent space-time in places, so you'd end up with funnels in the plane.
I believe I've seen similar images,
said Harry. So this time travel...
History travel,
she corrected. It's a space-time thing?
Oh, no, not remotely. But if you're looking for a visual metaphor, that one's as good as any.
She shrugged and the steering wheel wobbled in her hands.
This is more or less how it was explained to me.
More or less?
As I said, people talk and trade information. I've heard a few different versions of the story. We all have our own examples and metaphors.
Another mile passed by. Okay, he said. I have to know.
Know what?
Why? Why are you searching for this thing? What's the point? Harry turned and furrowed her brow at him.
Haven't you been paying attention?
Like you said, it's a lot to get your mind around. She sighed.
At a distance, with a large number of people, the dream can alter the flow of time and reshape the nation. If one person actually possessed it, held it, the entire United States and all its people would all be whatever that one person dreamed. They could impose their will on the whole country.
Eli blinked.
How? I don't know the details,
Harry admitted.
I just know the person who finds the dream can do whatever they want with the country.
But how do you know that? She shrugged.
As I said, people talk. They tell stories.
So, you heard gossip?
It's not gossip, Mr. Teague.
He opened his mouth, looked at her expression, and closed it again. 2 miles hummed by beneath the narrow tires. Eli shifted on the bench and rolled his shoulders. Okay, he said. Let's assume everything you've been saying is true.
It is.
Assuming it's true, he repeated. Shouldn't this happen to lots of people?
What?
Slipping back in time, or forward, I guess. Can you go forward?
Of course. Some of the slick spots extend decades into what you'd consider the future.
Okay, so why isn't it happening all the time? What's that joke? Where are all the time travelers? If these slippery spots, slick spots, are all through history, then shouldn't hundreds of people have slipped back to 1960 or forward to 2020 or where, whenever? Harry nodded.
True enough,
she said.
To be honest, quite a few do.
What?
As I said before, we've all heard the stories of the towns trapped in the past. Most motorists slip in one side and straight out the other. Then they drive home and tell their friends about the adorable town they drove through with 100-year-old houses that still looked new. There's also a limitation, she continued. Only American steel goes through. All those foreign cars, the imports, none of them will slide.
She reached out and wrapped her knuckles against Eleanor's dashboard.
Why not? I don't know,
said Harry. She punctuated it with another shrug.
I would guess because they're not American.
What about American fiberglass? Or...
I believe I was clear that a lot of this is second and third-hand knowledge. Yes?
He closed his mouth. You were.
Thank you.
The sun had almost vanished behind them, no more than a warm glow in the side mirrors. Ahead, the sky was dark, and he could see a few bright stars in the sky making their presence known. As if hearing his thoughts, Harry reached out and flicked another switch. The headlights flickered once and then surged to life, throwing a bright oval on the black pavement in front of them. You said most of the people drive through, Eli said. What happens to the rest? The ones who don't drive out the other side? She stretched one finger up off the steering wheel and pushed the point of her hat up away from her face. Her eyes stayed on the road, focused on the patch of light a dozen yards ahead of them. A quarter mile passed by under the Model A's tires. Harry?
Some of them just become lost for a while,
she said, as if she'd never paused.
They spend a few hours, maybe a whole day, lost somewhere else, and go home with a slightly stranger story. Some of them never find their way home, and they end up becoming searchers. A woman I know, Monica, hopped into the wrong taxicab, got into it in 1977, stepped out in 1936.
And the rest?
The rest,
she said.
Make too much noise. Too many ripples in history. So they're removed.
From the slick spot?
From history, Mr. Teague.
She shook her head.
They're eliminated. Killed. How many people are we talking about?
She shrugged.
200, perhaps 300 a year. There's no way to be precise.
300 people a year? He repeated. Harry nodded. 300!
Is there a problem?
How do 300 people go missing and nobody notices?
Of course people notice. Do you know how many people go missing in this country every year, vanished into thin air? Thousands. Since the day the country was founded. Why would those people lost in history stand out more than any others?
So how do they explain it when their bodies are found?
Their bodies aren't found, ever. They're removed.
Eli shook his head, trying to make all the pieces line up with the world he'd known just that morning. But how? By who? Harry glanced at him.
I think you can make an educated guess, Mr. Teague.
You mean the faceless men?
The faceless men,
she echoed. 14. Zeke heard movement around him. Not just him being moved past things in his wheelchair, but things moving past him as well. Shoes on carpet. Something went by with a squeaky wheel, and it made a picture in his mind of one of those little bookshelf carts librarians pushed around. The blindfold was soft cloth, like a t-shirt, but had enough weight to it that it settled across his eyes and cheeks. He couldn't see through it or under it. He'd woken up with it across his face after Agent 15 had knocked him out back at the station. His arms were strapped to the wheelchair, not cuffed. He'd been in cuffs enough times for enough reasons to recognize the feel of the double edge, even through clothes. He wasn't as sure about the restraints on his legs, but if his arms were strapped, his legs probably were too. Who had wheelchairs with straps on them? Prisons? Psycho wards? Feds? He didn't hear anyone talking, either. Or breathing. Even when someone moved by in a rush, he didn't hear them gasp for air. Just the sounds of the wheelchair on tight carpet and dozens of bodies moving back and forth around him. This blindfold's getting really fucking old, Zeke muttered.
Watch your language, said 15, his iron fingers flexed on Zeke's shoulder. Not much longer.
I don't like not seeing where I'm going.
That's the point of a blindfold.
Is some sort of black ops thing? I see something I wasn't supposed to? No one answered him.
He focused on 15. The big man had a solid grip on Zeke's left shoulder, and his voice had come from the left, but that meant someone else had to be pushing the wheelchair, unless the big guy was doing it one-handed. Zeke sensed a doorway around him, then felt it push through the air and heard it latch behind him. The wheelchair rolled forward a few more feet, then settled back and trembled.
Did wheelchairs have brakes? He thought they did.
Free his hand,
15 said,
and take off the blindfold.
Zeke felt a finger slide into the blindfold at the back of his head. The heavy fabric dropped down to hang around his neck like a turtleneck. He opened his eyes, blinked a few times, and forced them open again. The office looked old. Not dusty or worn out, just old. Like the captain's office with all its 70s furniture and out-of-date office phones, except this place looked like something out of a World War II movie. A typewriter sat on one side of a creepy, clean, and ordered desk. An American flag stood in the corner. An old safe with a big dial and a handle squatted against the back wall. Agent 15 stepped around to the far side of the desk and opened a drawer without sitting down. His hat had vanished, but he still had the freaky plastic mask over his face. The badge, notebook, and pistol moved from his coat and vanished into the drawer. He pulled a single file folder from another drawer, centered it on the desk, and opened it to look at the pages inside. A hand reached down from behind Zeke and unbuckled a thick, belt-like strap. He twisted around and saw another dark-suited man. This one had a feature-blurring mask with round cheeks and a smile, almost like a clown. Clowns creeped Zeke out. He turned away just as the strap came free. The man kept his hand on Zeke's wrist, pinning it to the wheelchair's wooden armrest. The wheelchair had the big wheels in the front. Dark creases marked the brown leather of the straps. Somebody'd fought to get out of this thing. Maybe a couple people. The man released his arm and stepped back. Zeke looked at 15, still reviewing paperwork.
Who the fuck? Art, the clown agent behind Zeke, rapped his head. What the fuck? You...
The knuckles cracked against his skull again. Zeke twisted around trying to grasp at the man with his free hand. His fingers never came close. The clown agent never flinched.
Officer Miller, said 15, I trust we can carry out this process in a professional manner.
What the hell's going on? Growled Zeke. You kidnapped me. You abducted a police officer. Do you know how hard they're going to come down on you?
15 selected a page from the file folder and set it down on the center of the blotter.
I'll need your signature on this before we can continue.
Fuck you.
The lights in the room brightened, turning everything white, and an instant later the pain hit, rocking his head forward. He took a deep breath and shook his head until his vision cleared. The back of his skull throbbed where the clown's punch had connected. He glared at the agent behind him, then at 15 on the other side of the desk.
Who the hell do you think you are?
We, said 15, are the faceless men behind the government. Our office served this country before all five branches of the armed forces.
He set his fingertips against the sheet of paper and spun it around. His arm stretched out and the paper slid across the desk.
Sign, he said, at the bottom.
Zeke looked at the blank sheet.
What is it?
Your contract.
It doesn't say anything.
It says everything it needs to. The conditions and term of your service, requirements of your position.
15 lifted a pen from its precise position alongside the immaculate blotter and held it out across the desk.
Now sign. At the bottom.
Zeke stretched out his hand and took the pen. He could just reach the bottom edge of the sheet of paper. He looked up at 15,
then back at the clown agent behind the wheelchair. He tried to make out any features, any expressions behind the plastic masks, but they blurred into nothing. Almost as if...
What is this?
Hissed Zeke, swallowing down a mouthful of fear and holding it down with anger. He retracted his arm, repulsed by the idea of what he might be agreeing to. He twisted around to stare up at the clown agent behind him. He couldn't see anything behind the clear mask. The skin wasn't blurred, it was just blank. No eyes, no whiskers, no mouth, no...
This is a chance to serve your country in the most honorable way possible, said 15. Sign the contract.
What the fuck are you?
Another punch to the back of the head rattled his teeth. Maybe not a punch, that could have been a nightstick. Maybe it had been his own nightstick.
Sign, Officer Miller.
Are you gonna kill me? What the fuck is this?
The faceless man in the clown mask stepped forward and grabbed his wrist, stretching it back out to the contract. Something twanged in Zeke's shoulder. He tried to drop the pen to fling it away, but the man's hand was already there to catch it and shove it back into Zeke's fingers.
Sign,
the two agents said in unison. Zeke liked to tell himself he was the bravest man in town. But when the two men talked, a couple beads of cold sweat left trails down his back.
Please, he said. Just tell me what this is all about.
Sign.
Even muffled by skin and masks, the word made the room tremble. His fingers fumbled with the pen and scrawled his name at the bottom of the page.
Excellent, said 15, sliding the page away. Thank you, Officer Miller.
He tucked the signed sheet back into the file and set the folder on top of the stack marked In.
Now what?
Asked Zeke. His shoulder throbbed. Was it dislocated? Dislocated would hurt a lot more, he figured, so he counted his blessings. The clown agent spun the wheelchair around. The office had a wooden door with a large window of bubbled glass. 15 walked past Zeke and retrieved one of two black hats that hung on a coat rack next to the door. He set it precisely on his head with one hand while the clown strapped Zeke's arm down again. He tried to fight, but it was like being a little kid and fighting with a grown-up. 15 opened the door and stepped out into the hall. The clown pushed Zeke's wheelchair after him. It was an old-looking building, lots of wood and plaster. Identical doors with bubbly glass, none of them labeled, not even a number. It reminded Zeke of detective offices in black-and-white movies. The hallway stretched as far as he could see to the left. Dozens, maybe hundreds of doors. Countless China hat light fixtures hanging from the ceiling one after another, making endless bright pools on the beady carpet. To the right, the hall went maybe 100 yards. It looked like it opened into a larger room, but Zeke couldn't be sure. The faint sounds of conversation and movement crept down to them. 15 started down the hallway, and the clown pushed Zeke along right behind him. The noise grew. Zeke thought about asking another question, but held his tongue. He didn't want to look stupid or scared. The hall ended at a set of double doors, each with a rubber wedge kicked under it to keep it pinned against the wall. Beyond them, Zeke could see the big room, a gym-sized room, at least. He glimpsed a press of bodies, a hanging chandelier, and then 15 led them into the room without pausing. Zeke had gone down to Foxwoods Casino a few years back for a long weekend. He'd never admitted it to anyone, but being there reminded him of one of the stories his mom had read him as a kid. The country mouse goes to the big city and finds it all too big and fast. All the people and sounds and lights at Foxwoods had been overwhelming. A sea of faceless men filled the huge room. Hundreds of them. All in dark suits of black or blue or charcoal, some with pinstripes or a fine herringbone twill. A few wore vests, others had double-breasted suits, the kind Letterman wore. They sat at dozens of desks and studied maps and marched through aisles in pairs and trios. It was Foxwoods times 1,000, set in a gigantic old-fashioned office.
Fuckity Jesus, said Zeke. How many of you guys are there?
47, said 15 without hesitation. And again, watch the language.
Zeke flinched, waiting for a blow to the back of his head, but none came.
What?
We pride ourselves on being polite and professional.
No, you dumb... Zeke bit down on his tongue, actually bit down and drew blood to make himself stop.
How's there only 47 of you if the room's full? 15 gestured down at the room.
This is all of us. Every version of every faceless man on every assignment at every point in our illustrious history.
Looks confusing as heck.
Better, said 15. It isn't. Confusion comes from distraction. We have certainty and purpose, so we aren't distracted.
Right, muttered Zeke. Purpose. They moved through the crowd. The wheelchair plowed forward, staying a few feet behind 15, even as other agents wove back and forth between them and alongside.
The press of bodies surrounded them, and from his position Zeke saw nothing but suit jackets, vests, and ties. A pair of faceless men walked past, heading the other way, and one of them thumped an elbow against the side of Zeke's head. A solid hit. Probably an accident, but his cop reactions leaped to the fore, angry at someone for not noticing his uniform even though he was strapped into a wheelchair. He wrenched his head around on reflex and barked after the faceless man.
Hey, Nimrod!
The outburst caught the clown off guard. His hands came away from the wheelchair. 15 paused and turned back. The two faceless men also stopped and snapped around as one, like a pair of targets turning on a shooting range. The shorter one, the one who'd hit him, wore a shirt and tie without a jacket. A dark vest, the same color as the man's slacks, covered his chest. No plastic mask or hat. The smooth curves of his face turned until his brow lined up with Zeke's. They stared at each other for a moment. Zeke wasn't sure where to look and ended up focusing his glare on the bridge of the nose, what'd be right between the eyes on a normal person. He could feel his pulse in his throat, but he knew better than to back down. He'd rather die brave anyway.
That was me,
the faceless man said after a few more moments. His muffled voice seemed uncertain, as if he wasn't sure he should apologize or not.
Damn straight it was, moron, hitting a guy in a wheelchair? What the fuck's wrong with you? Watch where you're going.
The faceless man's head stayed pointed at him. Zeke realized he'd just told a man with no eyes to watch. He wondered if anyone else had caught it. A few other faceless men around them seemed to have noticed the exchange. Two in dark suits were hatless. One dressed in tweed wore a round Dr. Watson-type hat on his head. Another had an old colonial triangle.
It's not important, said the taller man.
He wore a dark suit, an American flag pin, and a see-through Halloween mask like the rest of them.
He doesn't matter anymore.
He set a hand on the shorter one's shoulder, and they both turned away. The words created more beads of sweat inside Zeke's shirt.
What's that supposed to mean? Said Zeke. Hey, I'm talking to you, jackass.
That's enough, said 15. We're on a schedule.
The clown's hands settled on the wheelchair again. Zeke turned, a wise-ass remark swelling in his mouth. Then he twisted back around and caught a last glimpse of the retreating faceless men before the wheelchair moved on and they vanished into the crowd. The tall man with the dark suit, the pin, and the Halloween mask.
Was that you? He called to 15. You were here and there?
Probably, said the agent ahead of the wheelchair. Like he said, it's not important.
They left the big room through a single door and entered another hallway. This one was darker and more utilitarian. And cold. The chair's tires squeaked on a gray and white checkerboard of linoleum tiles. 15 led them past a few solid doors, turned a corner, and walked past a few more. An old stretcher, old like the wheelchair and everything else in this place, rested against one wall. Zeke eyed the thick leather straps and the splashes of blood on the sheet. The stain was more red than brown, still fresh. 15 turned another corner and stopped at another door, a twin door. Instead of handles, each one had a long steel and rubber bumper that ran up and down. A hospital door, Zeke realized. Made to catch gurneys on their way to...
Fuck a duck,
he whined. 15 pushed open the door with one hand and gestured Zeke inside. Darkness clung to the corners of the operating room. Rolling trays and tanks of gas lurked on the edges of the shadows, along with some 70s-looking machines covered in dials and knobs. The faint light simmered around the gurney in the middle of the room, held there by a big, mirrored fixture on a mechanical arm. A small pillow and clean white sheets covered its top. Long leather straps dangled about where the head, chest, waist, and ankles would be. Zeke puffed out a breath, and it steamed in the cold air. One of the trays rolled forward into the light. The scalpels and clamps and saws clattered against one another. Things of chrome and steel sat on the tray that Zeke couldn't identify, couldn't even guess at. Behind the tray, another faceless man stepped out of the shadows. This one wore a long white surgeon's scrubs and held his hands up to display heavy rubber gloves. A pale blue face mask hung around the man's neck, and a paper cap of the same color covered his hair. The doctor's white clothes pinched in the middle, and Zeke realized the man wore an apron over his long scrubs. It made him look like a butcher.
Hello, said the doctor. Shall we begin?
Zeke threw himself against the straps. The chair creaked, the leather bent, but nothing gave. He thrashed back and forth, wrenching his neck and his sore shoulder and his hips. Nothing budged. The clown slapped a hand down on either arm, squeezing Zeke's biceps as 15 unbuckled the straps across his forearms. Zeke tried to leap again as the buckles opened, but the clown's grip made him wince. He slammed his head back and heard plastic crinkle before he hit something that felt and sounded like a wooden block. A few white spots twisted across his eyes and faded. The grip didn't budge. 15 unfastened the straps across his legs and grabbed his ankles before he could start kicking. Zeke tried kicking anyway. He thrust his hips up at the faceless man, then threw them side to side.
On the table, please,
said the surgeon. He gestured at the small pillow.
Face up, head here.
They heaved Zeke up and stretched him across the gurney. The surgeon adjusted the pillow, placing it beneath Zeke's neck. Then he lifted the straps on his side of the gurney one by one, resting them on Zeke's body.
I don't know what they told you,
Zeke said to the surgeon, trying to keep his voice steady.
But I'm a cop. You can't do this to me. People will look for me. They'll find you.
The leather strap across his waist and wrists cinched down, pushing him against the gurney. Another strap compressed his chest. The clown vanished back into the shadows.
Do you hear me? I'm a cop. A police officer.
The surgeon set the last restraint across Zeke's forehead, right at the hairline. It creaked against his skull. The doctor paused, then pulled it tighter. His blank face panned back and forth. He nodded once, then stepped away. Zeke tried to follow the man with his eyes. He flexed his fingers and rolled them into fists. He stared up into the lights over the table and told himself he would get through this. He would survive it. And then everybody would know he was not to be messed with. Especially Eli. None of this would have happened if not for goddamned Eli. Zeke could still be back at the station, probably eating pizza, and a faint hiss echoed off to the side, like a gas stove waiting for the pilot to catch. The surgeon returned. He'd pulled his blue mask up to cover the lower half of his empty face. His hand came up holding a triangle of black rubber attached to a long hose. The hiss came from inside the triangle, and it came down toward Zeke's mouth.
Take a few deep breaths, said the faceless surgeon. In and out, count backwards from 10. And the next time you open your eyes...
Zeke stared up at him as the rubber triangle settled over his nose and mouth.
Yeah?
Well, said the surgeon, there won't be a next time after this.
15. Shadows stretched out and filled in all the space on either side of the road.
2 hours after leaving the town, the dark sky rose up ahead and came crashing down like a wave, leaving a foam of stars above them. Eleanor's headlights cast a bright oval on the road ahead of them as they raced along. Eli remembered his astronomy professor telling a story about Albert Einstein and headlights, but couldn't recall the point of it. Harry cleared her throat.
The Founding Fathers were very forward thinkers, she said,
her voice falling back into the practiced cadence.
They left ways to change the Constitution because they knew ideas change or fade away altogether. What's dangerous now can be harmless in a few generations, and vice versa. When they created the dream, they understood just how powerful it was. They knew how dangerous its ability to change the country could be in the wrong hands. So they petitioned Ptah to make guardians for it.
Petitioned?
It's how the stories come down the chain. You're interrupting again.
Sorry.
Supposedly Franklin had General Washington ask his best men for volunteers. Dozens offered their lives, but only 5 of them were found to be worthy.
Eli opened his mouth, but a glare from Harry cut through the dark and killed any words in his throat.
These 5 became the first of the faceless men. Their identity, their features, it was all stripped away. All they have is their duty to protect the dream.
Okay. Wait, she sighed.
Honestly, Mr. Teague.
You're saying they're not wearing some special mask or cloaking field or something? Like a mask under the plastic mask? They actually don't have faces. No eyes or nose or mouth. She nodded.
So how do they talk?
Or eat or breathe?
Nobody knows.
So how do they see?
As I explained before, certainty.
Yeah. But what does that mean?
It means they have absolute certainty of what's around them and what they're doing.
How, though?
Nobody knows.
Eli sighed and slumped back on the Model A's bench seat.
What little we do know,
said Harry,
comes from one of the greatest searchers, a man named Abraham Porter. He tested their range, learned how far their certainty reached.
How'd he do that?
He used a sniper rifle.
Oh?
Abraham is one of the very few searchers to ever kill a faceless man. Turns out they're only certain of things within 300 or 400 feet of themselves.
He killed one of them?
He killed 8 of them altogether.
Eli whistled. Then he straightened up on the bench. Wait. You said there were 5 of these... of them.
The first 5,
she nodded.
Since then, they've recruited soldiers and agents from across history. The Civil War, both World Wars, Korea, Operation Desert Strike, the One-Day War of 2029.
Jesus, how many of them are there?
There are dozens now, maybe hundreds. Time flows differently around the dream. I've heard stories that one of the original faceless men is still alive and over 1,000 years old because of all his time on the road.
Wait, he said. The dream's protected by dozens of these guys?
At the least.
All like the one that showed up at my job? Like in Pasadena, that tough, that strong?
Yes.
Are they all that strong and bulletproof?
They're not actually bulletproof.
They're wearing vests?
No, they just...
Her fingers tap-tap-tapped the steering wheel and the rhythm tickled the edges of Eli's brain.
You've perhaps heard stories,
said Harry,
where people are shot, but the round strikes at just the perfect angle, in just the perfect place, and they survive with minimal injury. It bounces off a bone without so much as breaking the skin?
I think so, yeah. She nodded.
That's what the faceless men do. Certainty allows them to know just how to stand or move themselves to be in that perfect position where the round will cause the least amount of injury.
So, they're bulletproof?
No,
said Harry.
Abraham proved that. It just takes a great deal of work to stop one.
And they're guarding the dream?
They were, yes.
Eli shook his head. How the hell did someone get past a few dozen of those guys to steal something? Hell, how'd they get past them and then back out of wherever it was?
Nobody knows.
Do you know who took it? She glanced at him and shrugged.
There's a lot of nobody knows to this.
Truer words, Mr. Teague. Truer words.
Eli sighed. The headlights of the Model A hit the glossy surface of a roadside billboard, turning it into a white rectangle. They drove past, and he blinked away the glare in time to glimpse All New Stardust Casino in curling letters on the sign. The faceless man who first came to talk to me, who followed me to Boston. He had a badge.
They do,
Harry said. I think he used it to hypnotize the crowd in Boston.
Like most badges, it's a symbol of power. It allows the bearer to ignore some rules and laws.
How?
Just having the badge makes them less noticeable. If it's out, they can influence what people see, how they perceive things. It's why people usually don't notice the masks or the lack of features.
And you know this because...
Abraham, again. When he killed one, he tried taking its badge, experimenting a bit. It worked for a while, but once they realized he had it, they could, I don't know, see around it, ignore it?
She yawned.
He tossed it in a trash can in Times Square on V-Day.
Why do they wear the masks, then, if the badge can make people ignore them?
Once again...
Wait, let me guess. No idea.
One thing we do know,
she said,
through hard experience, is that they were fanatical about protecting the dream. Franklin, Monroe, Jefferson, and the other founding fathers, even they weren't allowed in its presence again once it was created. They all knew it'd be too tempting for them.
Absolute power corrupts absolutely, Eli said with an absent nod. Harry tapped her nose twice.
Protecting it was the faceless men's only reason for existing. When the dream was stolen, it was their greatest possible failure. They became zealots, obsessed with getting it back.
Okay, said Eli. But that's good, right? I mean, if this thing's the foundation of the country, then it can't be a good thing that it's gone.
Not at all.
So if they want it back, well, why are you even getting in the way? She shook her head.
We're not. I said they were fanatical about protecting the dream. Their priorities have shifted.
Shifted how? Harry twitched on the bench. She rolled her shoulders, and with her grip on the wheel, it swung her body forward and back.
They searched for the dream for 100 years,
she said.
Through almost 300 years of American history. And somewhere in there, amidst all those rumors and stories and sightings of faceless men, the first searchers found out about the dream, too.
Okay.
Some of the searchers are not, shall we say, as cautious as others. They see the travel itself as a means to an end, manipulating events to serve their own needs.
But isn't that... Eli tapped his knee. Isn't that just making more ripples like you were talking about before?
Exactly,
she said with a sage nod.
Some of them are more devious, but the searchers who make extreme changes are hunted down by the faceless men as well.
Okay, so they guard the dream and they guard the timeline?
History,
she corrected. Right. But I still don't get what the deal is. If you're not messing things up in history, and you all want the dream found, then why aren't you...
They stopped looking for the dream,
she said, shooting another glance at him.
That's what I've been trying to explain to you. After 100 years of being unable to find the dream, they...
She paused to clear her throat.
They decided to focus more on the protecting history aspect of their duty. And they decided that anyone traveling through history was a risk.
Even if you're not doing anything?
Precisely.
Well, why keep doing it, then?
Because someone has to find the dream, Mr. Teague. How long can a house stand without a foundation beneath it? Even in your era, you must be able to see the unity of the nation coming apart.
I guess. Yeah.
When the dream is found, the country's underlying bedrock will be restored.
And you'll get your 3 wishes or whatever.
Someone's going to affect the shape the country takes, yes. Would you rather it be someone like me, or some greedy little weasel?
He shook his head.
This is nuts. And yet, still the truth.
As you were told it.
Yes, there is that.
Eli watched the endless night roll by, then focused his gaze on the bright space the headlights formed ahead of them.
It almost makes sense, he said.
In a weird sort of way. I mean, once you get past the fact it's nuts,
a lot of it does sort of line up.
It does. Still, I think I'll leave that part out when I tell people where I've been for the past week. He sighed. I guess I'll be leaving most of this out.
In the dark, her face shifted. He saw the movement.
What?
You won't be able to tell anyone.
Well, I have to tell them something, he said. He shook his head and pictured the questions from Robin and Corey, from his mom, from Bill at the bank as he begged for his job back. I've been gone over a week. People are going to ask questions.
The tip of Harry's hat shifted back and forth in the dark.
I thought you understood,
she murmured, half to him and half to the road.
Understood what?
Her fingers drummed on the steering wheel, the same half-familiar rhythm.
You'd already caught their attention. They'd taken note of you because you'd spoken with me twice before. But once they saw us together in Pasadena, once they saw us leave together.
Something twisted low in Eli's belly. Not quite nausea, not exactly a tightening.
What are you saying?
I'm not just answering your questions, Mr. Teague. I'm trying to teach you. You need to know all this if you're going to survive on the road.
No, he said. No, I don't. I'm not on the road. I just want to go home.
I'm so sorry,
she said.
You can't. When I said I was stuck with you, I didn't mean for the short term. They're after you now, too.